history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some men and women around you, seemingly ordinary Americans with extraordinary stories to tell, and we're privileged to hear them here each week. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn so much. We are educated. We're always entertained and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in Waterford, Wisconsin. A little more than 5,000 people live here. It's a pretty drive through rolling hills, grain silos, a little fresh fallen snow as I made the trip here to see Ken Vincent, who's turning 95 years old. He's lived in this part of the country for his entire life, except for the 4 years where the Army sent him halfway around the world. And we're going to hear about his experiences in the 3rd Armored Division in Europe during World War II. But before we get over there, let's talk about growing up in Milwaukee during the Great Depression. What do you remember about those years, Ken?
One of the things I remember is that my dad used to have a favorite expression. He couldn't buy a job. There was a period of time in the Depression where if you paid like, let's say $5, which was a big chunk of money in those days, you could get a job in some places. My dad was an electrical maintenance man. He ended up doing contract work out in Franklin. A lot of the homes and barns didn't have electricity, and so the people would have to pay him cash for the materials because his middleman had to have the cash. And then they would pay my dad sometimes half in cash and half in poultry, and one time someone gave him a runty pig. They'd pay him with eggs and things of this nature.
A lot of bartering going on.
Yes, a lot of bartering.
So did that pig become your pet or your dinner?
It started out as a pet, and then it ended up as our dinner.
And you were an only child, so that was probably your buddy. That must have been tough on you.
Well, I had a couple of close buddies. In those days, it was all farms, what is now the city of Franklin. In those days, Franklin was a township. Now there isn't a single farm in any of those areas. They're now cities. The city of Franklin, the city of Oak Creek, and so on.
And Milwaukee now is a big giant city with a Major League Baseball team and an NBA basketball team. But back then, none of that was there. What was the big attraction in Milwaukee?
Beer.
And you said your dad couldn't buy a job. But you found some jobs as a very young boy. How early did you start playing the accordion?
Well, see, my folks started giving me accordion lessons when I was 8 years old.
Uh-huh.
And by the time I was 12, I was playing, quote-unquote, professionally in honky-tonky taverns.
Uh-huh.
My dad would drive me to these places. He'd buy a beer and then sit way in the back. He just wanted to make sure that I got my money, you know. As I got older, I played in nicer places. I played downtown a lot in Milwaukee. Some of the ritzy hotels where they wanted cocktail music. They didn't want polkas and waltzes. When I was 14, I felt obliged to join the Milwaukee local because I was missing out on some jobs, and I stayed with that until I went into the service. The last place that I went that I played in, I had a contract for 6 months. It was a bar and restaurant with a dance hall. And I played with a little four-piece dance combo, a tenor sax, bow fiddle player, and a drummer. I played there 3 nights a week, Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday. I stayed with that until New Year's Eve of 41, because the 3rd of January, I went into the service.
Because something significant had happened about 3 weeks earlier, and I want to talk to you about that. But I want to make sure I really understand who you were way back then, too. So you start playing the accordion at 8, you're playing professionally at 12. Is it safe to guess that your ambitions, if there hadn't have been a war or anything like that, that your ambitions were lined up with music?
Yes, I had a dream, And they all say everything that we have starts out with a dream. I wanted to own a music store someday and have music teachers coming in there. But of course, that went by the wayside. After I came out, I went to school under the GI Bill, got married in June of 46 to my childhood sweetheart. I was very fortunate there. I met my wife actually in first grade.
Woo.
We both went to a rural country school, probably 50 kids, I think, in the whole school, two teachers, two classrooms, and four grades to a classroom. Often in the later years, we used to kid each other and say that we had such a good marriage, which we did, by the way, because we got our fighting out of our system when we were kids. And boy, we fought when we were kids. And I've got this a scar to prove it.
Scar on your forehead?
We were walking home from school one night, and my wife, her name was Mert, short for Myrtle. Mert was walking in front of me with a boy whom I detested with all my heart, and the feeling was mutual. And I was pulling on her apron strings. See, in those days, girls didn't wear slacks like they do today. They always wore skirts. I was pulling on her apron strings, trying to undo that bow that she had. And she swung around with her lunchbox and caught me right here with her lunchbox. And oh, how the blood flowed. And I ran home through the fields and I told my folks that a boy threw a rock and I didn't duck fast enough. I couldn't admit what had happened. Well, many years later, my wife and I and our two kids were in the living room. We were at my folks' house. The four of us were sitting around the kitchen table playing cards. Somehow the topic came up, and that's when I thought, this is a good time to tell them the truth. Well, I thought my mother and dad would fall off their chairs roaring with laughter. They just were convulsed with laughter. And to think that Mert got one over on Kenny.
Well... And you never would have come back to marry Mert had you not survived 4 years in the Army during World War II. I got to ask you, though, what was the point at which Mert went from enemy to ally? When did you start to think, hey, this is a girl that I might want to marry someday?
I was in basic training down at Camp Polk, Louisiana. And one day I got a letter in the mail at mail call, and I didn't recognize the handwriting on the envelope. And then I looked at the return address. Couldn't believe the name there. I opened it up naturally. Well, here it was, a letter from Mert, telling me all about her life, what she was doing, and so forth. Nothing romantic at all, not at that point in time. So I thought, well, I always had a hidden burning in my heart for her. Even when I went with other girls in high school. So I responded. Pretty soon, you know, I got a letter back from that one in response. We kept writing back and forth, back and forth. Gradually, I think we eased in the fact that we both liked each other. I think that's the way it came out. And then when I came out, why, naturally, we went together with serious intent. So in June of 46, why, we decided to make it official. She passed away in February from cancer. Darn, cancer is horrible. Had she made it until June of that year, we would have been married 65 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, good thing that she slugged you in the face with a lunchbox. Left an impression on you.
I sure did.
Literally.
Literally.
Well, everybody that I've talked to, hundreds and hundreds of veterans that I've interviewed, everybody seems to remember something about December 7th, 1941. Do you remember how you found out what happened?
Oh, yes. I had been out the night before on a playing job. A lot of times I play jobs went until 1 o'clock in the morning or a little bit later. But anyway, I got home after 1. Naturally, my folks weren't up yet, so I quietly went to my bedroom and went to sleep and always woke up late. And I came down and my folks made the sign of on their mouths with their fingers not to make any noise because they were both listening intently to the radio. Then my dad lifted up his head and said, the Japanese attacked us at Pearl Harbor. Well, now, I didn't know where Pearl Harbor was. I just knew that It was out in the Pacific someplace. That's all I knew. But the fact that the Japanese attacked us, you know, was enough for me.
And so, you were 10 days shy of your 20th birthday. So did it hit you immediately that this is something you were going to have to be involved in at some point?
Very shortly thereafter. I've been thinking about it, especially after my two buddies were picked up in the draft. I was working at Cutler and Hammer in Milwaukee. On the way to work, I said to myself, I'm just going to go down and enlist right now. So before I went to work, I went downtown to the federal building. I enlisted in the Army. I ended up getting my first choice armor, and that's how come I ended up in Camp Polk, Louisiana, because at that time, that was an armored training center, just like Fort Knox. When we were done with basic training, we went out to the Mojave Desert for 4 months, and they were going to train us for North Africa.
Right.
So we get done with our training. We get back to our staging area, which was Camp Pickett, Virginia. That was going to be the place that we would get on the boats. Oh, they gave us 30-day furloughs. When we came back, man, everything is packed up in boxcars and freight cars. Didn't even have a second duffel bag. The only duffel bag we had was the one that we carried with us when we went on furlough.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on here? And then they told us that we're not going to North Africa. General Montgomery, who was the British general of all the Allied forces in North Africa, managed to break Rommel's supply lines, and the whole German front was just collapsing over to Sicily and Sardinia and onto Italy, the foot of Italy itself. And so they didn't need a regular American armored division in North Africa. So they sent us from there up to Indiantown Gap, Pennsylvania, kind of up in the mountains. At that point in time, it was into December, and snow all over the place. And we didn't have the rubber tracks for our tanks and lighter tracked vehicles, like our 81-millimeter mortars, of which there were three of them, were all mounted in mortar half-tracks. Well, the rear wheels operated with a track system, and you had regular wheels in the front. Well, the rubber tracks didn't come through yet, and so there were a number of severe accidents. Some of those mountain roads were pretty narrow, and the curves were pretty sharp. I saw one spot where a light tank, it had a crew of four guys. It went down over the edge and just cleared a path all the way down to, I don't know how far it rolled. And I never went down there, of course, but the guys were just shaken to pieces. You had a wide belt across your lap that held while it just shook the guys literally to pieces, you know.
Killed them,
Yes.
You were confronted, even in the States in training, with how dangerous this is going to be, with nobody shooting at you. Just the nature of moving these armored vehicles around is dangerous.
Yeah, they sent us over to Britain in September of 43, prior to the invasion, and we trained over there. We used to say we were the best trained outfit in the whole army.
Because you had so much time to train?
Yeah. We did most of our training down in Wales.
But how did you feel about that? I mean, that's a long journey across the Atlantic, and you're still a young kid. How did you feel about all that? Were you thinking you're ever going to see America again?
Well, when we sailed past the Statue of Liberty, I was at a railing on this ship. I remember the name of the ship, the Leif Erikson. And I used to wonder, am I going to see that again coming back? Because a lot of my buddies, to my knowledge, are still over there in military cemeteries unless their families had them brought back.
Right.
And put in family plots. That happened, I know, in some cases. Other cases, the family felt that their sons or husbands or brothers, whatever it was, had close ties with buddies there. And that's true. You can't believe how close you are to your buddies. And so I think that's one way of thinking about it. Just let them rest in the military cemeteries.
Well, and there were some times where you came close enough to ending up in one of those, and we're going to hear about that. But is there anything else about those 8 or 9 months you spent in England for further training that stands out in your memories?
A couple buddies and myself were in London on a 3-day pass. When they talk about London fog, they're not exaggerating. It's the thickest darn fog you ever saw in your whole living life. This was nighttime on top of it. We're walking on the sidewalk, going across the Thames River. Oh, holy man. Suddenly out of this fog comes this monster. And this one buddy of mine, he had a couple of drinks too many. He got so excited he jumped over the railing right into the Thames River. Well, he didn't realize it, but had this happened a little sooner, he'd have fallen right on rocks and stuff. But this way he fell into the water, and this big English Bobby leans over the railing and says, "What the bloody hell are you doing down there, Yank?" Every so many yards across the bridge on both sides, they had life preservers with ropes, of course. This Bobby threw it over and he yelled down, "Crawl on this, Yank!" And that's where this Bobby could have pulled him up with one hand. Oh, you was a monster. Oh, is he big.
So we saw this imposing figure in the fog, but it was just an English policeman.
It scared the bejeebies out of the guy.
And did you get a glimpse or an understanding of how much damage had been inflicted on England?
Oh, unbelievably. Unbelievably. We were stationed at a little town called Warminster, and that was between two real big cities. On clear nights, what the Germans would do when they'd leave their airports over in France, they'd climb as high as they could. When their engines wouldn't pull them any higher, they'd cut off their engines and then glide over these cities before they dropped their bombs. Well, then we'd watch the searchlights cross on them. In many cases, it was like watching fireworks, only the real thing, you know.
Yeah.
We got to sit out on the steps of this barracks that we were in and watch this. It was something to behold. Sometimes German parachutists would drop out in our general area. My company was never called out to help search for them, but other companies in our regiment had been.
Hmm.
And they'd pick them up and turn them over to the local police.
It's time for our first break, but we're just getting started with 95-year-old Ken Vincent of Waterford, Wisconsin. From Normandy through the rest of the war in Europe, we'll hear about his close calls as well as the memories of a concentration camp that he can't erase from his mind. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right, consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's visit with Ken Vincent. His buddies in the 3rd Armored Division in World War II called him Vince. In Waterford, Wisconsin, they know him now as Kenny. We heard about his exploits with the accordion as a young boy, how he enlisted in the Army shortly after the attack on Pearl Harbor. And when we left off, he was in England. And I'm sure, Kenny, that you guys were starting to hear some rumblings about heading across the channel to invade German-held France.
First of all, we knew that Eisenhower was working on a thin little window of opportunity to make this invasion. We were already brought down into the, we call them cattle yards. They were nothing more than long, long fenced-in yards, devoid of anything but at one end, a portable kitchen, another end, porta-potties, and all you did was eat and sleep. Now, we couldn't figure out, for the life of us, we're an armored division, tanks mainly, and armored infantry. All the word armor in relation to the infantry means that where the tanks went, they went.
Right.
And vice versa. Because those tanks, see, I had my basic training back at Camp Polk in a tank outfit. And believe me, those things are blind. When you're inside, you've got the little rectangular slats you can look through, but they're blind for all practical purposes.
Right.
I think of the multi-millions of dollars that are in these tanks of today, knowing how they can be blown up by one individual.
Good point. But so while you're still there, you talked about the cattle yards. Did you guys get a report back about what had happened on June 6th?
On the afternoon of the 5th, we loaded up onto the LCT.
Is it an LST, maybe? Landing ship tank?
Yeah, landing ship tank.
Okay.
And we're just sitting there. And we were told that we had to be on the decks. We couldn't be down in the holds of the boat at all. We had to have our life jackets on. And we couldn't figure out why in the world we'd even be loaded like that, because no beachhead at that point in time was going to be large enough to handle an armored division. Then the night of the 5th, the paratroopers went over. They were so low, you had the feeling that you could almost reach up and touch them.
So you saw the planes heading over? Saw the C-47s?
The C-47s.
Towing gliders?
The gliders over.
You saw them take off?
Yeah.
But you're still on this ship?
Yeah. We couldn't see anything on the other side except a little pinkish-orangish glow, maybe is the word to use, because the paratroopers that had already landed had blown up things. There were fires going on over there, and what we saw were buildings burning from a distance, you know. Mm-hmm. But all we could see would be just a faint little line of pinkish-orange, because we're looking at something like 18 to 20 miles.
Yeah, so you're still just right off the coast of England,
yeah.
But on a ship prepared to be part of.
So then they have us get off in the dopey cattle yards again. Then we actually landed in Normandy, I want to say the 16th or maybe even the 17th. It was a nice clear day. We had no opposition whatsoever.
Two German planes came over, and as soon as they saw all the ships beneath them, they started to climb like crazy. They dropped their bombs just to get rid of their loads so they could be lighter and have a better chance of getting back home.
I never did see them hit with all the anti-aircraft that went up after them.
Well, I want to know what you saw when you got to Normandy, but I also wonder, have you ever been able to piece together why you guys didn't go over with the invasion force, why you were all loaded and ready to go, but were held back?
Because maybe someone realized an armored division takes room, elbow room. That beachhead that was established at first wasn't going to handle the division. And then when we went over, they had, by that time, had bulldozed all the garbage out of the way, and they had swaths leading up into the interior. Mm-hmm. And then we were guided into our jump-off point into some real deep woods, and we were told to dig foxholes and dig them good and deep, but that the Germans might throw over a few searching shells hoping to hit something, but we weren't to respond in any way, shape, or form.
Hmm.
And we were just to take it, in other words.
Yeah.
And I remember a shell must have landed close to a guy's foxhole, and he smelled the cordite, and he thought it was gas. So he yells, gas. Everybody was issued a gas mask.
Uh-huh.
We knew how to put them on because we had trained in that too. So we popped them on. Pretty soon, someone yelled, all clear. This guy, he must have just panicked, you know.
Uh-huh.
But we never did use our gas masks. A month or so later in the war, we didn't even carry our gas masks on us.
Mm-hmm.
We had them up in the carrier of our half-track. See, the rear end of every half-track had a big carrier.
Uh-huh.
And you'd put your duffel bag up there and any extra things, you know.
And sorry for slowing you down here. I want to go back one more time to June 5th. As you're loading that ship, have you ever thought, what would have happened to me if we did go over, if we hadn't been held back? Because you're all loaded, ready to go. Do you think you'd be here sitting with me if you had had to go over then?
You know, the emotion that I had most of the time, now remember, I'm 22, was, this is a big experience. I wasn't thinking about death. Death didn't hit me in the face until we jumped off on our first campaign. And what brought it to mind so was that that morning, early in the morning, right after the sun was up, everybody complained about the air vibrating in their ears, so, and a sound coming from someplace. We didn't have any engines or motors running or anything like that. Nobody could figure it out. Then one guy said, "Hey, look it up there." And he's pointing up, and between the clouds, you could see thousands of bombers, and they were dropping their bomb loads. Ahead of us, they'd taken a section of land so many miles wide by so many miles deep. When the lead bomber of each squadron would get to a certain point, it had to discharge its red flare. We saw oodles of red flares, and that meant that squadron was simply to get rid of its load. Don't worry about hitting anything. Hit an empty highway, hit a river, hit a lake, hit anything. Don't worry about it. That's what was happening. Well, one of the squadrons dropped its flare a little too soon. See, at that point in time, the 29th and 30th Infantry Divisions were holding the line. One of the battalions got clobbered by that bomb load.
American bombs.
American bombs.
So you saw American bombs kill American troops.
Ooh. As far as the eye could see, were dead GIs. Most of them were in pieces. Some of them looked like they got tired and just went to sleep. But if you took a closer look, there'd be blood coming out of their ears or out of their noses. The concussion got them.
Their bodies weren't torn apart, but the concussion just killed
that's
them from
right.
the inside.
And that's where we lost our first American general, a fellow by the name of McNair.
Yeah.
He came up. There was a problem of some kind that he wasn't satisfied with, so he came up and he got under that barrage.
That was July 25th of 44 that he was killed in his foxhole near St. Lo. And the estimate afterwards was that 77 American bombers dropped their bombs short of where they were supposed to and decimated the American lines. And it's been said that General Eisenhower was so upset about that that he instructed his generals never to use the heavy bombers in that tactical a fashion because it just wasn't going to be precise enough. But you saw that devastation firsthand.
Oh, yeah.
But give us a sense of what you had to do as an 81-millimeter gunner. You guys are, about five football fields back from the front line?
Yeah. First of all, a mortar generally is the most hated weapon on the battlefield. The Germans hated us above all else. We hated their mortars because, with artillery as an example, you could hear the stuff come in. You could hear your own going out. You know what caliber the stuff that's coming in is, but you've got a chance to hit the bottom of your hole. First of all, let me explain something that we tried to practice. There are three battalions in the 33rd Armored Regiment. I was in part of the 2nd Battalion. We would try to form circular encirclements. We'd work with the 1st Battalion over here. Our 3rd Battalion was always over on our left. And when we would meet, we'd have to hold until the infantry cleared out that pocket.
Right.
That might be 2-3 days. Well, we'd have our holes dug as close to our guns as we could so we could just drop down into the hole when things start coming in on us, because that shrapnel can make hamburger out of a man in a split second, can cut him absolutely right in half.
But with the mortar, you don't know when it's coming or where it's coming from.
The first thing you're going to hear is that awful screech when it's on top of you. I've been sitting on the edge of my foxhole with my feet on the bottom, and they started dropping in on us, and I wouldn't have a chance to hit the bottom of my hole when they were blowing.
It's how little warning you have.
Yeah.
So how close did they come to you?
Well, in our next squad, the 1st squad was always over here on our right. One of those mortar rounds landed right in the hole on top of a guy. Well, obviously, he never knew it hit him, of course, but I think someplace in the ether, he's still flying. Just indescribable.
Just blew him right out of the hole.
Oh, and blew the hole into nothing.
Yeah, and you see that.
Well, one time when I said that shrapnel can cut a guy right in half, I don't like to go into all these details, but I was serving that day as a number 2 gunner. I was the guy that would drop the round down the tube, kneeling on my right knee, and I would do this so that when that bugger blew, I wouldn't get my fool head blown off.
So you're dropping it in and you're yep. ducking your head away at the same time.
Yeah.
Right.
After this barrage ended, I get a crawl back up to my spot, and my number three man had the round already. He gave it to me, or maybe he threw it to me, because we got to the place where we'd actually toss them.
Because you're trying to get as many off as fast as you can.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
And I look over on the other side of the tube and see this tube is no bigger round in diameter than that, and it's down to the base plate, stands up about so high.
About 3 feet.
And where's my number one man? He's laying over in two pieces. A shell had landed, oh, I don't know how many yards, not many yards away from us. I remember the concussion blew me backwards. My back folded backwards.
Inside out.
Yeah, inside out. My feet were in the bottom of the hole, and my back was on the edge. For a while, I thought I broke my back. I remember the guy, his mouth was going. He was trying to say something. That was it. He bled out.
And he was 3, 4, 5 feet away from you?
Oh, yeah.
Just on the other side of the mortar?
Just on the other side of the mortar. No more than 3 feet, 4 feet at the most.
Wow. How does a 22-year-old kid handle this when you see a guy doing the exact same thing you're doing get disintegrated by a mortar coming on top of him? The guy right next to you, a few feet away, gets cut in half. And these are just two examples out of months and months and months of combat. How do you deal with that, and how do you avoid being paralyzed by the fear that the same thing's going to happen to you?
At first, it's numbing, if that's the word. Then after a while, you find yourself forcing yourself to accept it, and you become hardened to it. I actually believe you become hardened to it. I remember that night, though, I tried to get a few winks of sleep in the bottom of my hole. I don't think I slept.
I don't think anyone would blame you. When things like that happen, you mentioned being hardened, desensitized to it over time. But are there times when you see things like that and the thought comes into your mind, what are my mom and dad going to think if this happens to me? Do you find yourself saying a prayer or holding on to something that's going to give you some kind of hope?
Well, first of all, you've heard the expression, I'm sure, that there are no atheists in foxholes.
Yes, sir.
Well, now, in those days, I wasn't a Christian. I didn't become a Christian until after I seriously went with my wife. She became a Christian as a very little girl.
Uh-huh.
Her family was, too. So she was the one that, in later life, brought me to the Lord. But in those days, I wasn't. But let me tell you, I knew that there was someone more supreme than me. And I remember even having a little testament.
The military would issue a little pocket New Testament? Yeah.
I would try to read out of that. I remember laying in the bottom of my hole, praying to beat the band. Save me, Lord, you know.
Well, and you talk about that impact that your wife had on you, but again, you would have never made it home to marry her if you didn't survive all these things in Europe. And a couple of questions come to mind for me. One, you talked about three different mortar squads in your platoon. So how many people is that total?
About 30.
About 30. Out of those 30 guys, how many of them were still in that outfit when you finished the war?
Well, we shipped out from Camp Joyce Kilmer in New Jersey for Britain. I would say there were 8 or 9, maybe 10 of us all together that shipped out from the States.
Uh-huh.
The rest were replacements. The ones that didn't make it were either bad casualties and eventually were sent back to the States or were killed.
And that's what I'm getting at. You made it through to the end, but I get the sense that the odds were against that.
I was in what was known as Headquarters Company, 2nd Battalion. The Headquarters Company had a tank platoon, a mortar platoon, a reconnaissance platoon, and an assault gun platoon, and a maintenance platoon. The assault gun platoon was absolutely wiped out to the man.
Nobody left.
Nobody left. The reconnaissance platoon, that was wiped out. They turned over like 200% because those guys all went to motorcycle school down in basic training at Camp Polk.
Uh-huh.
Then when they were finished, they were assigned to different companies. And a lot of messages, it wasn't felt, could be safe to be sent by radio, so they used motorcycles. I remember one of the guys who was our physical combat instructor. He was what you'd call the soldier's soldier. You could see him on a poster. Join the army, you know.
Right.
Handsome guy, built like a, I don't know what. That very first morning, his motorcycle was laying on one side of the road. He wasn't even completely off of it. He was still partly on it. A little hole drilled in his skull right below his helmet. And yeah. I remember his name even to this day. His last name was Avery. A likable guy. Oh, he was a likable guy.
One of the more than 406,000 Americans killed during World War II. Such a heavy price paid for the freedom we all enjoy. And Mr. Vincent mentioned that casualty rate of 200% for the reconnaissance platoon. That means it had to be completely replaced two times over because of deaths and injuries. The 3rd Armored Division lost more tanks in combat than any other division. It lost more than 2,500 men and had another 7,500 wounded. That's more than 10,000 Purple Hearts issued for just 231 days of combat. So many of those casualties were inflicted during the Battle of the Bulge, and we'll hear how Mr. Vincent experienced that legendary battle when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with Ken Vincent of Waterford, Wisconsin. He's celebrating his 95th birthday this weekend, and there are 2 children, 5 grandchildren, and 3 great-grandchildren who wouldn't be here to celebrate it with him if he hadn't survived some close calls in Europe during World War II with the 3rd Armored Division. Can you share some of those close calls with us, Kenny?
We were going up a draw one time, and I almost got myself court-martialed over this and came to a pillbox. And there's a little stubby gun sticking out of it. And I saw that bugger move. And I said, let's get the H out of here. And me over the side with my rifle. I no sooner hit the ground when the ground just shook. The half track came to a lurching stop. The left front wheel had blown completely off.
From that pillbox?
From that pillbox. Then the squad sergeant said, let's get out of here. Well, it's almost too late.
And there were times where it wasn't just close in, the guy to your left or your right is getting killed. There were times where you got pieces of shrapnel.
I had a couple pieces of shrapnel during the Battle of the Bulge penetrate my overcoat and the jacket I had underneath my overcoat, but didn't pierce. I didn't even know that I felt nothing other than the blow, but I just figured it was a stone or something, you know. And then pretty soon one of the guys said, hey, Vince, you had a piece of shrapnel sticking out of your coat. And he pulled it out, showed it to me, and I carried it in my pocket for a souvenir for a long time.
You didn't bring it home with you, did you?
No, I lost it someplace along the way.
How big was it?
Maybe about so big.
Maybe 3-4 inches?
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned the Bulge. I've talked to so many guys who were there, and this is a huge, huge battle, thousands and thousands of troops. But the enemy that was shooting at you, and many times was secondary to the enemy that was freezing your feet or your nose, your fingers. You're from here in the Midwest, where you get snow every year. The winters are no joke in Wisconsin.
That's right.
Have you ever experienced anything like the weather during the Battle of the Bulge?
No, because in the Bulge, we didn't have the clothes that we should have had. The rear echelon guys had the warm boots. We had just the regular combat boots that we always wore. The warmest thing we had was our overcoat.
And what were the conditions like that you were dealing with?
Oh, snow on the level almost up to your knees in the open fields. I remember 3 days before Christmas, my outfit got cut off on the forward slope of a hill. There was a little village, a little Belgian village, on this hill. Because we couldn't get our wounded out, we used the basement of the village tavern. I'll never forget Christmas Eve if I live to be as old as Methuselah. 3 times they sent their infantry in amongst the houses and into the houses.
The Germans did. And you guys are in these houses?
And yes. When we first went into the village, and by the way, there was nothing in this village, no furniture, nothing in these houses. And the people knew well in advance that the war was coming in their direction. So they took off with everything they could take. The first day, our combat engineers around the base of the village strung a tripwire with sea ration cans, couple little pebbles in it, and grenades. And that night, when the Germans sent in their infantry the first time, it was great. They set off these grenades. But the second time, they tried to come in, forcing a flock of sheep ahead of them.
They wanted the sheep to set any tripwires, huh?
Yeah. And the third time, they tried it themselves, but they were so decimated by that time. Evidently, we had figured out that this outfit was commanded by SS officers. Any unit that was commanded by SS officers fought to the death, practically.
Right. So the Germans keep coming and coming.
Until they used up the bulk of their manpower and finally gave up.
That must have been some hairy days for you, though.
Oh. See, I was, besides being a gunner on the mortar, I also was allowed to volunteer on rifle teams on our flanks. We always had a team out on each flank and one in the front, 2 guys in each team. Why I say that is that the very first day we were on the rifle range in basic training down at Camp Polk, we were given 5 rounds. And in a prone position, I put the first round just as it was touching the black, the other 4 right in through it. Near me were 2 officers. There were several guys laying in a prone position. One of the officers, who had a clipboard in his hand, walked up to where I was and he said, "Soldier, where did you learn to shoot like that?" And I said, "Squirrel hunting with my dad." And that's how I did learn. My dad taught me how to use the .22 when I was 9. He used to say, if you can't hit a squirrel in the head, you let him go. Because if that pellet goes through his body, sure, you may kill him, but that pellet chews up too many bones. And then when it's cooked, and my mom always made stew, then you got those bones in your mouth and those sharp little things. So my dad figured, if we can't hit him in the head, we let him go.
Yeah.
And I can remember to this day, hit him in the head.
So you demonstrated your marksmanship there,
yeah,
so they knew. But I thought the first rule of the Army was never volunteer for anything.
I didn't have brains.
So you volunteered.
I volunteered for something just for the excitement of it, I guess. I volunteered a couple of times to go out on a reconnaissance patrol at night. And both times I got myself lost.
You're lucky you didn't get yourself killed.
That's right. Because I lost contact with my contact man, and I don't have a good sense of direction. With a map and a compass, oh, you can't lose me. But I'll never forget that first time. What do I do? We were near some woods. A lot of the woods in Germany, in fact, I don't think I ever saw any that weren't artificially planted. I think all the natural timber had been long since used.
Right.
And the timber that they had was all nice, straight, even rows, you know. And any branches, anything that fell to the ground would be brushed up into piles and ultimately burned. And people's stoves. Well, I found one of these piles, and I crawled underneath the thing. Now, let me tell you, Paul, I'm not fooling. It's scary, because GIs are noted to be
Trigger
happy.
Trigger happy, sure.
And here this line of infantry with the tanks in between them coming my way, and I'm waving my helmet.
How long had you been hiding under there?
Hours.
So you got lost in the night and had to wait till morning?
That's right. I figured this is my only chance, you know, so that's what I did. The second time, I didn't volunteer. I was volunteered GI style. Vince, you and Johnson and so-and-so, you know. And I got lost then. Only that time, I found a foxhole. I'd often heard of foxholes being booby-trapped, so I remember taking my rifle and staying around on the edge as much as I could and moving my rifle around in that hole before I crawled down in it. And, you know, both times my name was on the, not the honor roll, believe you me, it was on the morning report.
As missing?
Missing in action.
Uh-huh.
Well, the company commander wasn't too happy about that, because when I showed up, he had to go through the paperwork of changing it, you know.
On the cold at the Bulge, I mean, around Christmas there, you're holed up in that village. But were there other times where you had to sleep out in a frozen foxhole?
Oh, oodles of times.
And how did your fingers and toes and other extremities handle that?
Well, I lost my toenails. I wasn't hospitalized. I remember the medics just rubbing some ointment on it of some kind. I had two pairs of gloves. This is kind of dangerous doing this, but a lot of you guys did it. We call it liberating. We'd go into people's houses and go through their dresser drawers, finding things we could wear. Socks, as an example. I found something that fit over my head and buckled under here. At least my cheeks and were taken care of.
So kind of like a makeshift ski mask that you fashioned.
On the order of a ski mask, yes.
Uh-huh.
Because, like I said, we didn't have clothing for that cold weather. And we didn't have the hot food.
You know, you get through the Bulge in January, but you've still got another 4 months of fighting to go. You guys crossed the Ruhr River and the Rhine. Your division liberated Cologne.
We crossed at Bonn, which is a suburb of Cologne, between Cologne and the Rhine River. When you got to that point and looked over Cologne, all you saw was rubble, with the exception of one building that was left intact, the Cologne Cathedral.
Very famous images of that.
Yeah.
That had to make quite an impression on you to look out and see that.
It really did. By that point in time, I had seen so much destruction. It was common, like when we went into the Ruhr Valley shortly after we entered Germany. The cities and villages were leveled. I'll never forget looking down into the valley with binoculars and knowing that some of the factories were still being operated, but by slave labor, which we didn't know.
Right.
We thought it was Germans, you know.
Well, you mentioned that slave labor, and I've talked to some guys who are convinced some of those slave laborers saved their lives by sabotaging some of the artillery shells they were producing. You know, there were duds that would land near their hole, and they lived through that. There's so many different directions, fascinating history there. And in some of these factories and situations, that slave labor were people who had been put in concentration camps. Were you aware of what the Nazis were doing to the Jewish people and other prisoners?
No.
Hadn't heard anything about it?
No. We weren't aware of that until it just so happened that our column of vehicles was held up right at the main entrance of a concentration camp. It wasn't the kind that had, like, the ovens or anything like that.
Uh-huh.
These were political prisoners, but they all looked like walking skeletons, absolutely walking skeletons. And the stench was enough to gag a camel.
Mm.
And two or three of my buddies and myself walked right in the place, didn't go in any buildings, couldn't stand the thought of that. We thought we were pretty hard to a lot of things by that point in time. The smell, I'd smelled death, but this was not only that smell, but all the other odors mixed together.
Mm.
A big, long, open ditch, and the dead each morning would be dropped in that ditch and then covered over with lime or sometimes earth. And so we guys stayed in for a little while. They were bringing up long lines of ambulances, trucks, to transport the internees to wherever they were going to go, we thought, well, let's get out of the way.
You land in France late June of 1944. The war ends in May of 1945. So that's a little shy of a year that you spent engaging the enemy. How long did it feel like?
Felt like an eternity at the time.
And out of all those situations, the extreme cold of the bulge, the artillery, the bombs, the small arms fire, everything you dealt with, is there one situation that when you reflect now you say, yeah, that was the closest. That was the closest call or the most fortunate situation I was able to survive?
Being cut off back in France on a rather steep hill. One of the things I remember was that everybody, no matter what your job was, had to empty out the ammo racks and naturally the mortars and bring them up to the top of the hill. There were some huge, huge boulders as big as rooms. We set up our mortars up there. We didn't need any forward observer, believe you me, because when daylight came, the Germans threw lines of infantry against us. It was almost like, what's that expression, shooting fish in a barrel, until we ran out of ammo. Then we just had to sit and wait and hope. And then our tails were saved by, they were called P-38s.
Yep.
It had the twin fuselage.
The Germans called it the fork-tailed devil.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And sounds like this is a situation where it earned that reputation.
We called it our own Air Force. The 3rd Armored Division had a squadron starting out the war with the P-38s. A little bit later in the war, it was the P-47s, and the P-38s were sent over to the Pacific. Then we ended up the war with P-51s. These P-38s had silver bodies, and I remember how they glistened in the sun, and they worked in pairs. The first pair had come down, strafed a tank to make sure that the tank stayed buttoned up, and then the second one would fall right behind with a pair of, those are heavier bombs, I don't know what their weight was, but they could literally tear a tank apart, and they strafed the infantry several times, and that was it.
And you told us you ran out of ammunition.
That's right.
You've got nothing else to do. The Germans are still coming.
The P-38s finished up the job.
But if the P-38s weren't there,
oh,
they're going to overrun you.
That would have been the end.
You would have either been a prisoner or you'd be dead.
Yep.
So I guess you like P-38s.
I sure do.
Can you describe for us what that feels like? To be basically helpless. You can't fire anything else at them. They're still firing at you. And then these planes come to your rescue. What did that feel like inside of you? What were the emotions that you experienced?
You want to jump out of your boots.
And you mentioned that when you headed over and you saw that Statue of Liberty, you wondered if you would see her again. Did you get to sail back into New York Harbor?
Yep, on the Queen Mary.
So you see her again coming back.
You bet.
And she kind of symbolizes everything you were fighting for, doesn't she?
You bet. Wonderful, wonderful feeling.
I want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us these stories that only you could tell us.
You're welcome.
And I'd like to know, as you look back on it, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Yeah, I'm thankful I came back.
Aren't we all? That is Ken Vincent turning 95 this weekend. Happy birthday, Kenny. We enjoyed a long conversation, and some of it wouldn't fit into our radio time. So if you want to hear more, including his experience with Stars and Stripes Honor Flight out of Milwaukee, you can find all of that on the extended podcast version of today's episode at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.